Well, good evening, everybody. A special welcome to Rosie Baradotti, who will speak to us tonight. But before I hand the word over to our honored guest, I wanted to give a few reflections on the lecture series that will only be two lectures and speak to our motivation as Stella Schindels and mine, why we actually invited a couple of speakers to think with us about the question of how to think differently from Europe or Europe thought differently. After 4 years of working in a program that was entitled Europe in the Global World, adopted at the Center of Excellence, my colleague Estelle and I felt some burning need to question the still widely Eurocentric knowledge production and the concomitant power relations. Three circumstances provoked this desire. First, we had discussed all kinds of empirical relationships between Europe and the globalized world throughout 4 years, from different historical and contemporary perspectives and using different conceptual and theoretical tools. Also, we came together from very different interdisciplinary angles, so we had to have a conversation of how we go about our questions epistemologically that needed us to explain to each other where we were coming from and where we were going to and what kinds of means we were having. And third but not least, last but not least, I feel that there was a discomfort with the relationship of Europe and the globalized world, this crude juxtaposition that either implicitly or explicitly spoke to Eurocentrism in the setup of the whole thing. All three aspects, intellectually and sometimes also emotionally, bore many insights, but they left us with unanswered questions that we wanted to grapple with. And after 4 years, we felt it's a good moment to invite actually a couple of speakers that their intellectual history, their careers really have engaged with these questions epistemologically. Because after all, we had realized that thinking outside our box, outside of our own intellectual upbringing, is not that easy after all. So under the headline, Thinking Differently from Europe, Europe Thought Differently, we are glad that the Center of Excellence gave us the means to invite a couple of speakers who critically contributed to the field of contestation I have tried to briefly line out. And I'm really honored that I could receive already at lunchtime today Rosie Baradotti here in Constance. Exceptional work on epistemology, developing such concepts such as the nomadic subject or also the post-human, putting alternatives forward to subjectivity, difference and diversity, as well as critiquing universalism, cultural relativism, and liberal individualism, all provide a basis for a thought-provoking and enriching contribution to our lecture series. Rosie currently is a professor, a distinguished university professor at the University of Utrecht, where she currently heads the Center for Humanities. And apart from amazing track records of guest professorships and fellowships, she just recently actually gave the Tanner lectures that maybe she will also let us know a little bit about on human values at Yale University, on the post-human, all too human. That was the heading for the Tanner lectures. Rosie, I'm very pleased to welcome you today here. And I'm really looking forward to hearing more from you about the inspiring title you gave us, On Becoming Europeans as a Nomadic Political Project. Thank you very much.
Dear Tilney and Dr. Hale and Dr. Schindel and their teams for inviting me here. I had heard about Constance for a long time, so it's a great honor, a great pleasure to be here. And thank you all for giving up a sunny afternoon to be in a stuffy room to hear about a potentially very annoying topic, which is a topic of Europeanness, European Union subjectivity. And the first point that I want to make is indeed why it is an annoying topic. Why, if I were to say, I want to come out from the start as a vehement European federalist, half of you would want to leave the room screaming and say, I would not have respected that of you. I want to sort of zoom in on Euroscepticism and a deep sense of discomfort with both Europeanness and, by extension, the project, the idea, the incomplete vision that is the European Union. And whether first started working on this, it was part of my nomadism work, it's almost 20 years ago, good Lord, on the becoming minor, becoming nomadic, processes of transformation, whereby dominant categories, and Deleuze, my teacher, describes as majoritarian, dominant categories get destabilized, get moving, get deterritorialized, and get into a progressive transformative spin and start moving. It's part of a political movement. Nomadology, nomadic thinking, post-Marxist, profoundly anti-Hegelian, profoundly neo-Spinozist, that is trying to put motion back into activism, put the active back into activism, giving a politics for the center. And actually activating the center is a deeply uncomfortable political move. Any Hegelian, and I'm really looking forward to hearing, I hope you recorded Mignolo's talk, any Hegelian, you can tell this from the title of the talk, knows where history is going. It's part of a Hegelian philosophy of history that you can predict what the next phase of historical development will be. That's what... to predict the course of history so that you can predict the angle of intervention in which an intellectual class can then do what an intellectual class is supposed to do, make an intervention. This vision of the political, this vision of the philosophy of history is what my teachers started challenging the day after May 68. Yes, May 1968. The morning after, when President de Gaulle won the elections and it was quite clear that the Great Revolution of 68 had not managed to change anything, although it changed contemporary culture to a very large extent, the teachers that were my teachers of my generation, young Michel Foucault, a young Gilles Deleuze, a very young Tony Negri, a very young Etienne Balibar, started investigating the basic premises of a Hegelian Marxist philosophy of history, saying, is this the way that we can go about actually conceptualizing the task of critical theory and the task of the intellectual? Is it about predicting the evolution of capitalism, the breaking points, and when we can identify the breaking point, guess what? We will have a politics and we will have a mission. The breaking points, the idea that capitalism will implode from within its own contradictions, that the contradictions are so enormous that necessarily they will bring the epistemological break, is what was questioned from starting from the morning after May 68. And it took the form of a return to Spinoza. When people inherited some of this French theory, mostly in English translation, filtered through what I describe in my work as the transatlantic disconnection, American reappropriations of French philosophy, in what became known, depending which area of studies you're in, but certainly in cultural studies, as postmodernism. Don't ever, ever put that word in any of your application or you'll be dead on arrival. Not to be mentioned in polite company, but postmodernism, post-structuralism in philosophy, much more respectable, somewhat safer. But what that post, with all the ridicule and the complications, but what that post really should have been followed by is the only meaningful description for that generation. It's post-Marxism. It was the vote of non-confidence in a Hegelian philosophy of history. The turn to Spinoza happens then. In 1979, the year that Tony Negri writes his best book, The Savage Anomaly, a study of the role of the imagination in Spinoza, that year Pierre Macheret writes already an overview of critical neo-Spinozism, a book called Hegel or Spinoza, question mark, Hegel or Spinoza, translated into English in 2011, at the back of the Deleuze fashion. There's a small little gap there when you think that every other masterpiece of postmodernism was translated immediately. We have to wait until 2011 to get this basic point that was lost in translation. Post-structuralism was a post-Hegelian movement of thought. Post-Marxist movement of thought that promoted critical Spinozism as an alternative political philosophy. Why? Because they did not believe anymore in the predictability of a Hegelian Marxist philosophy of history, that did not believe that being a political intellectual meant accelerating or decelerating, but waiting for the breaking point. My Marxist friends are always sitting somewhere waiting for capitalism to break. Well, 1972, Deleuze and Guattari write the first of a massive masterpiece, subtitled Capitalism as Schizophrenia, Volume 1, Anti-Oedipus, Volume 2, A Thousand Plateaus, to defend a basic, simple hypothesis. Capitalism doesn't break, it bends. It bends. It adapts. It swallows up. It's flexible. Why? Because it's made by us. It's made by universities. It's made by knowledge. It's made by cognitive capital hitting what we call civic society. But by today, if we talk at the production of knowledge, the distinction between civil society, the corporate, and the university is almost non-existent. Are you against capitalism? Take your iPhone, chuck it out. Take your phone and laptops, chuck them out. And if you are not prepared to do that, well, you better take a quick look at the mirror and start a minimum amount of self-reflexivity. That is the breaking point. The breaking point that makes nomadic thought possible is a serious revision of what counts as the political and what is the task of critical minds who inhabit one of the multiple centers that constitute the global economy. To think, even in 72, let alone in 2017, that Europe is the center of anything is really making ourselves quite a flattering self-portrait, one of the centers. I think if you are a graduate student, your chances of publishing your PhD are much higher if you're coming out of Bombay or Sydney, certainly, than if you're coming out of Constance or Utrecht. What center? What are we looking at? And again, the single-minded sort of Hegelian fixation with center-periphery, dialectical thinking, binary thinking. How about scattered hegemonies, to quote Kaplan and Greville? How about a scattering of multiple re-territorialized centers? And how about the whole of Europe as a massive, wealthy periphery, living off looted and produced wealth, but certainly not the center, a center. So this shift from the to A, to the complex multiplicities, and this necessity to think a politics for the centers is the beginning of this operation. And it means abandoning Hegelian Marxist dialectics for a much more rhizomic, flowing understanding of multiple differences, and scattered hegemonies, not one center, and stop the romanticism of the margins, whereby the only borders that matter have to be a long, long, long way away, far away, and then we have to go. Should we go to Mexico and California? Should we go to, how about Constance and the city next door? How about the territories that zigzag in and out of each other? What happened here during the Second World War? What happened here during the First World War? I would love to go back in time and see. What is it about Europeans that makes it so difficult for us to take accountability for our territory? Is it the hangover of a Marxist Hegelian vision of the political, whereby the political has to be in Latin America, right? If not, where else? It can never be here, certainly not in Zurich, never. It has to be far away, romanticism of the margin. And is it, as Nietzsche suggested already a long time ago, self-hatred that makes it so difficult for us to take stock of our own positionality, of our own territory, of our own multiple complex borders, as if looking at ourselves filled us with the greatest, what is it, contempt, self-hatred, and boredom? And what is exactly? I want to throw this really at the start, because the politics of a center looking at its own visions, delusions, hangovers about being a center, our inadequacy, the illiteracy, actually, that we display in talking about our Europeanness otherwise than in the stereotypes, margin, center, guilt, and breast beating. The lack of a discourse about the center proves not only my other teacher Michel Foucault's point that the center is dead, the panopticon is empty, there's nobody there, it's a self-replicating vacuum, but it also proves the difficulties, and that's Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, of generating energies, starting from this dominant formation, these dominant centers where actually not much is happening. How do you create energy, political, visionary, epistemic energy, if you're locating yourself at the center, a center that is self-replicating void? How do you get active back into activism? It was Spinoza's question. Spinoza lived in terrible political times. The 17th century was not a picnic. You think 2017 is bad? Try the end of the Dutch Republic. The collapse of an entire political system. Collapsing badly, not cheerfully, with lynchings and with disenchantment and with heartbreaks. And imagine thinking joyful affirmation in the midst of a time like that. And Spinoza argues very eloquently, it's because of the decline of the what we would call the master narratives. He didn't speak like that, but never mind. The decline of the ideals of democracy in his case, because of the state of decadence that we're in, precisely because of the negativity of the times, we need to think affirmatively. It is a praxis. It is a project. It is hard work. I think this is what brought me to the nomadic European project. I was very worried, and I remain worried, about the ease with which Euroscepticism seems to have become part of being a good lefty, of being a critical intellectual. There must be something wrong with you if you say, actually, Europe is an incredible opportunity, it's an amazing project, let's make it work. There's something wrong with you. So we need to look at Euroscepticism from the right as from the left, the two mirror faces of populism. Marine Le Pen and Corbyn have in common the hatred for the European Union. Marine Le Pen is open about it, Corbyn is not. That's the difference. He's pretending. But he's in fact a Brexiteer. He's as much pro-Brexit as Theresa May, in fact, even marginally more. Left-wing Euroscepticism, whereby the EU is the devil, the incarnation of capitalism. And of course, Trump is not, Theresa May is not, and Boris Johnson is not. Pinning on the EU every single sin of capital. That's the Euroscepticism, enormously influential in the Italian referendum, in Podemos, etc., etc. EU equals global capital equals death. On the right, EU equals end of nationalism equals death. Mirror images of each other. I believe that all populisms are exactly the same. I've written about it. Go to IFLUX, my article against Donald Trump. I'd never liked Zizek, but after he came out in support of Trump, that really did it. In case you were tempted to like the guy, think again. Oh yes, because Donald Trump is less dangerous. For whom, I would like to ask, speaking as somebody who is carrying in her body some anatomical part that you would like to crutch and grab, less dangerous for whom? A Euroscepticism, mirror populism, in other words, in this case, a total displacement of the left-right partition, left-right division. This was the politics that I grew up with, between Badiou preaching the return to Leninism and Marx, and Deleuze saying, let's go with Spinoza and reinvent a politics for what was then the 20th century. And the project of Europe emerged from that. So on the one hand, the work on nomadism, non-unitary identities, destabilize the center. The centers, wherever they are, have a task to accomplish. They can also just have solidarity with the margins. It's fine, we can do that. It's not either or, and. But we can maybe do something to activate the center. And the politics of affirmation, anti-dialectical politics of difference, whereby it's a praxis, it's a practice to generate the activities, the encounters, the relations that would give us the energy to do what we can't do. Imagine different futures, imagine different scenarios, the energy, the visionary energy that Marxism gets with the antagonistic work of the negative, and Spinoza gets through the alchemy of the affirmative, the praxis of generating joyful affirmations. I think this is the context, in a sense, we could stop and start the conversation. But I wanted to say quickly to apply to the European case, present your argument, then we can shoot holes through it. I would argue that Euroscepticism is fed by ignorance and that people simply do not even remember what the origins of the European Union are. Or if you do, those origins are coated in such feelings of guilt and mistrust and self-hatred that we do not even want to talk about it. Do we remember what the origins are? Not just the Marshall Plan and the reconstruction of Europe that came later. The real origins of the European Union is the punishment for fascism. It's the punishment for having actually two world wars, two Franco-German wars that escalate into world wars. The punishment for the Holocaust, which, if we listen to our dear friend Paul Gilroy, I should remember, was just colonialism brought home. We did to the European Jews what we had done in the colonies for generations. We just brought it home. Okay? That was the point of non-return. The Allied forces with the International Jewish Council, with people like Albert Hirschman, whose sister Ursula Hirschman was the wife of Altiero Spinelli, the first European commissioner, sat down and said, listen, you bunch of fascists, this is the last time you are going to make war on each other. Never again. The first treaty that was signed by the European Union was the Coal and Steel Industry Treaty. Does that ring a bell? The Ruhr Valley, the Krupp factories, the rearmament industry. The first thing that was signed, never again will you guys even have an army. To date, our army is NATO. Somebody better tell Trump, but I don't think he can spell it, so he will not know what that is. No army, no wars, no rearmament. Thou shalt be disarmed and now get off and do some work. Okay. Punishment. People hated it. Do you think that Italy enjoyed being subjected to this? Germany had no choice. You're occupied up to your teeth. Nobody wanted it. Nobody enjoyed it. Spain, of course, was never in the picture because Spain stays under fascism until... 75, thank you. Portugal, 76. Greece, 74. Fascism goes on in Europe. There's not stopping 45. And half of Europe is still under, while the European Union comes as an anti-fascist organization. Punishment. And when Habermas, the grand wise old man, I never agree much with him, but I always respect him enormously. When Habermas says it's a post-nationalist project, he's completely correct. That's what the project is. Post-nationalism. Never again. And of course, by today, we can see what the response to that is, but let's stay with the facts. This is the history. If you look at your constitutional history or the various administrative histories that mark the European Union, it's quite clear what's going on. Of course, immediately, it's the Cold War, so Europe becomes the window displays of Western opulence, and it fulfills that role in opposition to the Russian debacles. Immediately, the Cold War redistributes the roles, but it remains completely clear. You do know, well, you Germans, you do know, what the Berlin Wall was called on the eastern side. Or are you all post-89 and your memory has disintegrated? What was the Berlin Wall called on the eastern side? Anti-fascist barrier to us being the fascist, in case you've forgotten. Okay? This is the history. So instead of breast beating and going into guilt tripping, can we just stay lucid and clear and look where this comes from, how necessary this project is. And this explains immediately the opposition of the right-wing nationalists. Of course they're going to hate it. It flies in the face of everything they believe in. They are the old-fashioned nationalists with a few little adjustments. They are now pro-Israel and pro-gay, just because Marine Le Pen's leading campaigner, Florian Philippot, is an LGBT activist, but is still a fascist, and it's in my books, and no matter what, this is the gay bourgeoisie speaking here, speaking on behalf of lesbianism, and I shall call him his face, no matter what his sexual politics are. So there are minor readjustments, but they're still the good old fascists, they're still the same nationalists, and they hate the European Union. They are perfectly coherent. Their objection makes perfect sense. I despise it, I disagree it, but I do understand it. If I switch to the left-wing opposition to this, I do not even begin to understand the premises. They bear no relationship to the history of this organization, to its legal structure, and to its professed vision. None whatsoever. It's an ideological scapegoating, as far as I can see. This is for the history. Now the philosophy. Okay, the philosophy. Europe is a philosophical question. The question of Europe haunts philosophy. From Hegel onwards, the old continent breeding the future, the little baby called the United States of America, where the sun rises, that will give us the future, the vigor, the inspiration of the youth. That vision of Europe as not just any place, but as the place where human reason has found its location. The location where subjectivity meets reason, meets moral judgment. Kantianism gone galore, just gone berserk. And you will find it in Locke, you will find it in Hume, all of them apologists for the empire and for colonialism. White man's burden does not come out of the empty air, it comes out of a specific civilizational rule for, and vision for Europe. This is the place of reason. This is the place of human rights, I'll have you know. Well, okay, the Congo, yes, well, never mind, detail. I think you need all the roads here go back to empire, to colonialism. White man's burden, a civilizational vision of what it means to be Europeans, and here philosophy played a role that we can't even begin to analyze. So little work done on the complicity, in fact, it's not even a complicity, outspoken support of transcendental consciousness and universalist vision of reason and empire, colonialism, a certain idea of Europe. A few years ago, when we tried to have that famous European constitution, there was a committee that wrote the preamble. Remember the preamble to European constitution? It was chaired by Giscard d'Estaing, had too much cognac, I'm pretty sure. And it started with this vision, Europe, transcendental reason, universal consciousness, human rights. Woody Allen says, when I hear Beethoven's Ninth, I want to march off and invade Poland. exactly the same. You just want to off and invade something. I have to punch somebody up. Something has to happen. That vision, it was just 10 or something years ago, that idea of Europe. And I think we need to start from that idea of Europe, mix it with what I just said about the plan of the European Union, and see the European Union as an antidote to the Eurocentric vision of Europe, to this grandiose, hypocritical, imperial role that still leads so many European countries to not actually even acknowledge that a portion of their wealth may come from colonialism. The Dutch seriously believe that they are wealthy because they are stingy, because they save money. I'm sure the Germany is borderline. Portugal, did Portugal ever have an empire? No, sir. Spain and Latin America, two worlds apart. And this complete, what is it? A sort of brain damage that we have in relation to the multiple empires that have constituted the surplus value that has financed European industrial development. I think we need to start here from some pretty basic, you'll be happy, Marxist-Leninist conditions of production argument here. Stop this idea that it is our genius that generated our wealth. We went out, we conquered, we looted, we raped, we came home, and we financed. And then we did many other wonderful things. We are a wonderful culture. I am not a Euro-pessimist. It's not a question of either or. It's a question of and. This is 2017. Can we have a complex reading of our history? Can we stop simplifying that which our history has made complex? So the idea of a European question, Europe as a philosophical question, and the European Union as a revision of what it means to be European, a revision that was imposed on us. We did not volunteer to do it. It was the price to pay for two world wars. And it was implemented very firmly by the first generation of great, I think, titanic intellectual figure, Ursula Hirschman, founder of the first pan-European feminist organization called Femmes pour l'Europe, Women in Europe, whose archive is still in Brussels somewhere, married to Altiero Spinelli, an incredible family, still exercising amazing influence on how we should go about becoming new European, written into this program, the transformation of what it means to be European. It's really Européen, encore un effort, as the French would say, make an effort, go a step further, get a move on. That's the spirit of this operation. And I think to sort of dismiss it for whatever reason, well, breaks my heart for one thing, but also raises issues about how do you imagine that we can undo Eurocentrism when Europe is our location. So we go back to the politics of positionality, also known as the politics of immanence, and I do it with feminism because it's always been there before, the politics of location. Start from where you are at. Start from where you live, take accountability for where you're at, and from there, spiral outwards. Do not speak from nowhere, and do not simply fall for cheap universalism or the romanticism of the margins. And how do you undo Eurocentrism when you're a European critical intellect? It's Nietzsche's question. So many of us, writes Nietzsche back in 19-something-10, don't feel at home in Europe. So many of us Europeans don't feel connected to this culture, are critical of this culture, and yet we are of this culture. This is where Spinoza is the political philosophy that one needs, the philosophy of immanence. We are contiguous to the conditions that we are critiquing. We are part of the problem, but also part of the solution. Whereas in dialectical thinking, this is called complicities, or you are sleeping with the enemy, you are contaminated by the very power formations that you're critiquing. For the post-structuralist, think of Michel Foucault on power. Power is not something that one class has and the other class doesn't. You don't do power with has or have. Power is a complex strategic situation that we are in. It's the ontological turn. You do it with, you are in power, different degrees, different connotations, and different quantities and qualities, but power is at least two-leveled. Potestas and potentia, the power that confines you, conscribes you, and contains you, power as entrapment, institutional power, potestas, and power as empowerment, enabling you to do things, potentia. When you're a professor, what is it? 75% of the time is potestas, and if we're lucky on a good day, we have 25% of potentia. We can activate our students to actually get things done, but most of the time we service the institutions. It's good taxpayers' money. It's what we're paid for doing. We do it humbly and gratefully. Nothing wrong with power. Unless you are in a Marxist-Leninist and paranoid structures of thought. And this is where the Spinozist intervention was in Foucault's on power. He was 67, 68, saying, can we revise our understanding of what it means to be powerful? Foucault writes this when he gets his chair at the Collège de France. If you know anything about the French education system, being a chair at the Collège de France is like being a demigod. And he does his inaugural lecture called The Power of Discourse, saying, here I am. I'm a professor at the Collège de France. I'm one of the gods. I will devote the rest of my time to critiquing the power of the professorship. And he starts his work on critiquing of power of discourse. And he does it admirably, rigorously, dies a little bit too young, naughty boy, and leaves the work unfinished. But the intervention is of the greatest importance to open the gates to what then, in some ways, Derrida, but certainly massively Deleuze and Guattari do, making power a process ontology of affirmative praxis. That's the operation here. And the becoming minor of Europeans is part of this political maneuver. We take a dominant notion, we move it, we transform it in the direction of something that we want to enact to bring about. European Union is the site of transformation, a transformation that forces us to confront our aporias, our guilt and our illiteracy about ourselves, and which I will maintain, speaking as a feminist and anti-racist, has to do with fascism on the one hand and the enormous deafening silence about colonialism and empire on the other. And colonialism here has to be put in the plural. There isn't a single European country that did not have an empire. Denmark still does, still has Greenland, and Denmark was the seventh slave trading nation in the world. I know this from a project called Nordic Colonialism that I've been involved in through a couple of PhDs. So there is nobody here that is, in a sense, outside this particular, shall we call it, pluriformative of imperial configurations. But the silence about this is deafening. And I would argue that the more we're ignorant of our multiple imperial pasts, the more we are inarticulate about migration, borders, and otherness. There is a direct correlation between the two, because these foreigners don't come out of thin air, they don't come out of Mars, they come from a thick history of contact, trading zones, and commerce and trafficking. And so something here about the role of critical education and in bringing back deafening silences about our history. And here critical theory, post-colonialities, anti-racism, enormous role to play. So already this, I can sort of imagine you're getting already a little bit edgy on this, but bear, so this is the first level concerning the structures of subjectivity. Becoming European is a transformative project, becoming minor, deciding together where this should go with the switch, Hegelian Marxist, to a Spinozist. And I can make you a whole list if you read some of my recent work. I have entire bibliographies of how enormous the switch to Spinoza has been, with a question mark, how come we didn't notice it? But I already gave you some hint about the postmodernism erasure of this. There is a citizenship side to this. And this is the other level where I lose track of my political family, the left. I do not understand how the left thinks about this. And it has to do with citizenship laws, with European passports, with European nationality. If there is one model of citizenship that we should be proud of, it's the European EU citizenship model. Because it is a citizenship model that is not connected to territory. Or in other words, it's although it is simpler and faster to become a European citizen if you are born national of one of the countries that is a member of the EU, although it is more automatic in some ways, it's not the only way to do it, and it is not how the citizenship law has been conceptualized. In fact, the citizenship law has been disconnected from territory, and where this trick of European citizenship has played the most is in the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland, which is being threatened by that brilliant stroke of political genius that is Brexit. The old Northern Ireland peace treaty actually applies the citizenship rules of the EU that disconnect territory from citizenship. In other words, wherever you may be born, you need to become a European citizen. There is a second level of citizenship thinking. You have your, shall we call it, national identity. Good, very, very happy for you. That national identity, by the way, may or may not coincide with an ethnicity that is autochthonous to that nation or not. You may be Swiss from Moroccan parents or Afghan refugees. So you may have a nationality that does not correspond to the ethnicity that you would expect from that slide of the world. That's already something. And Switzerland is an excellent model. So ethnicity, national identity, citizenship level, becoming European, that is just speeding preferential lanes if you are from a member state nation, but it's not the only way to do this. And this is the argument that has been used by people like Ulrich Preuss, another legal thinker, but Sheila Ben-Habib also saying, but we have a very interesting model of citizenship here. and it's the argument for flexible citizenship. A citizenship model that is not absolutely connected to blood and soil and earth and all of that. All of that is there at the level of your national identity, but the citizenship level is another level of thinking, much more advanced. You become a European. The passport says Kingdom of the Netherlands, European Union. Federal Republic of Germany, European Union. It's the national level is there, but it's as if there is another, shall we call it, plateau, let's go with Deleuze on this, of thinking about a becoming citizen. Now, what Preuss, Benabib, myself have argued, here we have a flexible model of citizenship. Suppose that we apply this across the board and we say, and it would be legally, absolutely feasible to say, anybody who lives on our territory, works and pays tax, is a citizen. For the amount of time that they spend on our territory. What was that that somebody said once? No taxation without representation. Okay, we have all these people working, picking tomatoes, picking strawberries on our territories for a couple of weeks, 6 months, disappearing the rest of the year. Why would they not be citizens for that amount of time? Legally, totally feasible. In fact, ready to go politically, unthinkable. Because these are the alien others. These are the refugees that we don't want. But there is here a very interesting hiatus between the legal structure that we have and the political good or bad will to implement it. The legal structure is very advanced. The legal structure is very transformative. The legal structure could be activated towards part-time citizens of the EU for the amount of time that these people spending with us. This assumes, in other words, that these passing hordes of foreigners that are in our midst, the refugees, the migrants, the alien others. Remember that image of Brexit, of Farage in front of that storm of refugees coming to destroy the British way of life, whatever that may be. That fear of otherness. Well, that assumes that instead of going into the xenophobic spin, we accept mobility, hybridity, creolization with my beloved Edouard Glissant as a feature of our times. It's just a feature of advanced capitalism, a feature of the moment that we're going through. They're not going to go away. If we could go around this room and do a mapping of where everybody, including myself, is coming from, purity had better leave our schemes of thinking once and for all. It's about hybridity, it's about mixity, it's about mobilities. Different modes and different variations. From all of my favorites, who can get a job anywhere and get citizenship immediately. Who was a tennis player that walked into Melbourne, became an Australian immediately? I'm Australian myself, Italian-Australian. So I thought, that was quick. From the mega stars that can get their citizenship as part of their pay packet, to, of course, the refugees and the ones for whom the Mediterranean is a solid sea. How about accepting mobility as the feature of our time? Nomadism as the defining feature of the 21st century? How about giving up on soils, grounding, and fixity, the paranoia of one root? How about we stop with roots and we go with rhizomes? How about we don't do reason, but we rhizome, as Deleuze taught, thinking laterally, thinking relationally, thinking in very impure ways. What I would say thinking European Union is about thinking in these terms, thinking the interconnections, thinking these borders that zigzag in and out of each other, thinking that we are in this together as one of the centers, by far not the only one, but one of the centers that can rethink its function and play a role. Why is this not enough to give us a politics, to excite our imagination, to give us a sense of purpose as intellectual? What is it about the European thing that is a constant deficit? I wrote a piece once saying, why does Europe not make us dream? What is it? And I think until we answer the question of why it can't go like, yes, I want this, I think we're going to be swimming in a sea of yogurt, waving our fog and confusion and not having a clear sense of what this Europe thing could become. How do you construct a transnational social imaginary? If you're like me and a good old Italian girl at heart, when the Italian national team plays, it's very difficult not to go, yeah! You've seen Bread and Chocolate, the famous film about Italian migrants in Switzerland, when the national team plays. It's a famous test in England. It's cricket, of course, the famous citizenship test. When the national cricket team plays, are you for England or are you for the colonies? Sport is a really good indicator. Why does nationalism make our heart beat faster? And in my case, it would be the football moment when I go, yes, and when it's Italy, Germany, of course, it's almost a classic. But it can be something else. Some people get this at the Eurovision Festival. Some people get it at the Tour de France, not my case. How do you construct a transnational social imaginary? Do we need to go with Spinoza on this? Spinoza, who says the imaginary, the imagination can only be constructed collectively. It's not just a projection of the self, it's a collective enterprise. And what do we want to become? And what kind of subjects are we in the process of becoming? What Deleuze would call the collective assemblage, and a we. There's not an I projected onto a national ideal, it's an assemblage projected into a collective enterprise. Is the difficulty of a transnational social imaginary the fact that we have to say goodbye to all that, goodbye to things that are very dear and precious to us, simply because they are familiar? Some people, I'm thinking of Julia Kristeva, get tears in their eyes, because she said it, when they hear the national anthem. She says when she hears La Marseillaise, she breaks down into tears. That's Julia Kristeva, not my favorite, but some people get that with food, with dialects, with regional accents. Try to locate it, because everybody has it with something. A shape of the landscape, a smell in the air, when you know that this is home. And that gets you. That really gets you. Is it that undoing our attachment to nationalism is like defamiliarizing ourselves from what is so near and dear? And then I would have to cure myself of the little micro-fascist reflex that goes, go Italy! It's according to Deleuze and Guattari, it's a micro-fascist reflex. Go Italy, go, go, kill the Germans, go, get them. Is defamiliarization, disidentification, the pain here? Is this the pain of letting go of the familiar? I believe that Deleuze and Guattari wrote Anti-Oedipus as a treaty on defamiliarization, how to say goodbye to what is so familiar, so near and dear, that you repeat it almost by inertia. It becomes a reflex, and those reflexes need to be looked at very, very carefully. Both feminism, postcolonial and race theory, teach us that disidentification is a painful process, and that acknowledging that you're white, although you are all kind of other things as well, including an anti-racist, a feminist, an LGBT, a good citizen, a devoted professor, but also white, acknowledging categories that are drenched with guilt and negativity, and acknowledging them as part of your repertoire, actually hurts. And race, postcolonial feminist theory say that's actually a healthy dose of pain. And it's good. It's good for you, as mother would say. Isn't that horrible? But it is good to you epistemically. It is like the shot of, can we do this with the pharmacon of Derrida? It's the shot of the antidote that makes you aware of the poison. It is the immunity system reacting and saying, yes, of course, you absolutely enjoy the advantages of whiteness at each moment of your existence. You don't have to do anything to enjoy the privileges of it. But then you're also many other things, a complex molecular assemblage. You're not just one thing, but factor in also the negative part. Yes, as a woman, I'm mentally rapable. As a lesbian, I ought to be gang-raped. As a feminist professor, I am a big-time swinger, and I can make or break a few careers. Just give me a chance. And it's not power as empowerment or power as entrapment. It's and learning the process ontology, the fluidity of the processes. How come we live in levels of such complexities, and yet we are not capable of representing that complexity when we're thinking about ourselves. There is a representational deficit here. And I believe that's what Deleuze, Guattari, Derrida, all that generation, Henri Garrido, we're all trying to say, we have a representational deficit. We are not like that. We are not in the 18th century. It's the 20th. Things are complicated. And they didn't even take in as much as they should have new media and mediation. If on top of everything that they did, we now also put in mediation, we can talk about complexity. And this is the new phase with new materialism, object ontologies. We have mediation coming in as yet another layer. Think of the complexities of your position. You millennials out there, I'm still in Gutenberg in my structures of thinking. Complexities. Defamiliarization hurts. You have to let go of something that reassures you, and yet it is the beginning of wisdom. Maybe in letting go of a certain idea of Europe, facing the necessity of having to become Europeans otherwise, of having to make an effort to discover, to create together a social imaginary that would sustain a desire to become otherwise Europeans. Maybe that's too much work, as one of the Brits, Brexiteers, said to me. Oh, that's too much work. Too many nights out, he said. We'd rather go on with our British things. So, go on with your British thing. Transformation. If we are the place that is historically condemned to its own history, which is the definition of Europe that we get, Balibar, but also Foucault, because of our complex and checkered history. If the duty to remember to transform is what makes us European, well then, we can start from that epistemic ethical injunction, go with Spinoza towards the collective construction of a project and a becoming European otherwise that we can only do by acknowledging and the positivity and the negativity. It's the end generating energy in the process by the transformation of the negativity which is confronting us at each step of the process. First and massive, the negativity of our own relationship to our being European. It's not a great relationship. Not in Germany, not in Italy, maybe it's easier in other countries. It's drenched with complicated emotions. When Foucault wrote that Deleuze, and he wrote in the preface to the American edition of Anti-Oedipus, Foucault writes a beautiful preface saying what Deleuze is really doing, he says, he's accomplishing the denazification of European philosophy. Now, Foucault was many things. Generous is not one of them. Foucault was not. That he should pay such a compliment, it's the same essay where he says, un jour le siècle sera Deleuzian, one day the century will be Deleuzian. We didn't know which century he meant. It looks like it's this one. The denazification of European philosophy. Why? Because it cures us of our sick relationship to power. Power is the negative that we never have. Other people always have it. And if they have it, they can do two things. Use it against us, and then it's big bad daddy punishing us, and it is, for Deleuze, the figure of Antonin Artaud crying out into the void, I want to stop the judgment of God, enough for the judgment. Or it can be the Donald Trumps and the strong man who solve the problems for us. And we pin our problems on them, and they are prompt. Berlusconi, wasn't he great? He solved so many problems. The man of providence, cometh the time, cometh the man. And we're at the moment between Brexit and Trump, we're in the middle of this type of appeal to a strong man. But projecting power outwards is a way of not taking it on upon yourself. And what he means by the denazification of European philosophy is systems of thought that encourage you to put power somewhere out there so that they can solve the problems for you. And then you're either the victim or, you know, the poor accomplice, but it's out of your hands. Politics of imminence. Get right in there. You're part of the same problems that we're trying to solve. Embrace that condition in order to transform it. It's humble. It's ascetic. It's painful. It puts the ethics before the political. It is the ethics that gives you the politics. That's Spinoza's turn. But it gives you a hands-on approach to what I would call the process of becoming European as desiring ourselves as different types of subjects. And the question again would be, why would this not be enough? Not only to give us a politics, but also to give us a sort of an injection of energy, something that would want you sort of, that may want you just sort of jump up and say, I actually want this. What is it that is simply always falling short when it comes to Europe? What else do we need to have a European politics than to transform our own self-representation, our own collective representation as becoming Europeans? What are we waiting for? And in the absence of what I would call a progressive leftist answer, we have mirror nostalgias, the nostalgias of the right and the nostalgias of the left, the nostalgias of Marine Le Pen, who wants sovereignty and the nation state, and the nostalgia of the left, who wants to break capitalism represented by their vision of the European Union. And those mirror nostalgic projects are stifling our, I would call it, revolutionary energy, if I can speak like Deleuze for a minute, the power of affirmation that is the only thing that can generate a politics, the power of dreaming otherwise, of imagining different scenarios. We are stifled by conflicting modes of nostalgia. European Union, transformation, becoming minor. I'm going for it. I hope you will follow me for at least some of the way. Thank you for your patience. Almost on time. Now you can start shooting and punching holes through everything. Do you chair from here? Do
yeah,
I?
Yeah. I can chair. I think everybody can hear me like that as well. Grace, there's already.
I was even disciplined with time.
You were still disciplined. Oh, okay. Well, let me just in a very first reaction. Thank you for this inspiring talk, this wonderful lecture at the end of term. We could definitely do with something like that more often in terms of the energies that you put into this room. That was wonderful. Thank you very much. You did answer a number of questions the further you went along in your talk, so that it's also wonderful to sit and say, oh, this question is gone.
But it was a lot of stuff.
So. I already saw some hands up.
Very good.
I won't take the space of the chair to actually answer my question first, then, and I'll take
a few. Maybe we can take two, three questions, two.
I take two and three together, and I try to do my best job as a chair and don't overlook anybody. There's a microphone, please use it. So then I would give the word to the lady in the very back with the curly hair.
If you can tell us who you are, social security number, the usual stuff.
Thank you. You rocked my world. I have 100 questions, but I'm going to ask one. How might this project of becoming this transformation be informed by the possibility of integrating, incorporating, embracing the presence of
a simple question, just throw it in like that.
Thank you very much for an inspiring talk. I'm very happy to hear such kinds of talks more frequently than I used to in the past. There was one just last week by a social anthropologist, James Ferguson, which went in the same direction. So I think this is a very good development, and it was really inspiring. So thank you very much. My question concerns a topic you didn't really address, but it's in your title. It's the topic of nomadism. And as a social anthropologist, forgive me for asking the question. I'm sure you must have answered it many times.
Sure, sure.
I'm someone who's working with people who used to be nomads. And the world over, the place for nomads has been shrinked by precisely the nation state. So I wonder whether, when you chose this metaphor, you were not yourself romanticizing something which doesn't exist anymore. Because if there are people who cannot move as they wanted to move, but as they did move in the past, it's
okay.
Would you revise the term, or do you still?
Oh, no, I wouldn't. Okay, so let's start with, this is a very important question. It belongs to, sorry, but I mean, I'm much older, to nomad thought is really 1890s, is the first wave of post-Marxist thinking. It's the first discussion, what is politics without the dialectic, so without the necessary antagonism that comes from the binaries. So it belongs to that. And if you go back to the 1990s, you will find a lot of literature, and including some nasty ones, on particularly by anthropologists, say, oh, what are these philosophers doing with nomadism? So let's get this straight. And the original citation that Deleuze gets is from Nietzsche, and it comes from Neumann's Snobs, from the idea of the law, and what is the origin of the legal territoriality of our systems, and it has to do with ownership of the land, the transition from nomadism to settlement. That's the moment, and the birth of the city-state. You can do it with Marxist anthropologists, and the transition from the nomadic state to the first settled communities, which then become the first city-states, which become oriental despotism, which is the whole saga of human evolution, shall we say. And I think in the case of Nietzsche, as in the case of Deleuze, they want to focus on that moment precisely to start the what I would call the Spinoza's political project of questioning the validity of the law. Who says that particular code of law imposed at that particular moment gives you ownership of the land? Because with the ownership of the land, with agriculture, the whole thing gets up and running. In feminism, the culture of settlement and agriculture, patriarchy goes up and running, and the ownership of women is on a level with the ownership of cattle and camels, and a correlation between the quantification of female bodies and the acres of land. So it's an absolutely crucial moment. And they focus on it to undo, shall we call it, the holy status of the law, particularly in Kantian theory, which is still the legal foundation and the moral foundation for our political order. I don't know how much longer this will last, but I mean, people should remember what Immanuel Kant's definition of a citizen was. Just in passing, just to refresh in your memory, a citizen was a legal male born of the city kind of person who didn't have to work for his living. So by that definition, unless you are the child of the son of landed aristocracy, I don't think anybody in this room was a citizen for Immanuel Kant. So can we sort of update some of this and sort of stop this veneration of this universalist system? There's a very big discussion here with critical Kantianism. And of course, do I have to remind you of the conversation between Habermas and Pope Benedictus XVI when he was still Cardinal Ratzinger in the famous Wood conversation, 2004, if I'm not mistaken, but Habermas and Ratzinger are discussing the issue of the law. And Ratzinger, who has, I think Ratzinger has such a Nietzsche problem. He dreams of Nietzsche at night. He really does. And he says, I can't believe relativism. And he says, well, he says, you know what the thing is about Christianity, and that goes in your direction. The thing about Christianity is the only religion that has an intrinsic relationship to reason. I'm repeating because I have to repeat it to believe it. The only religion that has an intrinsic relationship to reason. Ratzinger, 2004, and Habermas, yes, sir, just converted, of course. What natural law, Kantian universalism, the fabric of our order. Well, Deleuze and Guattari are going for the killing, and they're saying, just a moment here, what are we sacralizing? So that's the origin of that. And it's very, very targeted. And I think what you need to do to see how it immediately becomes political is to go to Edouard Glissant, The Poetics of Relation. Go to the postcolonial application of this. Glissant. The thing with postcolonial theory was just a pretext for English literature to take over the world. Nobody has done postcolonial theory in any other language. If we'd done postcolonial theory with the French, we would be in very different places by now. Glissant, early 80s, Poetics of Relation, Creolization. There's no such a thing as a national language. When the French landed in Guadeloupe, it wasn't Académie Française with Racine on their head. It was a couple of fishermen from Brittany speaking the local sort of patois or whatever they were speaking, meeting the indigenous population. Together they created another concoction that is another language. There is no purity. There is only hybridization. I think that this is the becoming nomadic is part of that conversation. On the one hand, the critique of the naturalization of the law. On the other hand, hybridization, movements. There has never been holy lands. It's all contacts and transitions. So that's the first set of answers. And I think they were slow, Deleuze and Guattari, in responding to it.
connected to it, and there I was fasting, replying, is the issue of metaphors. These are not metaphors. Nomadism, the posthuman, the feminist philosopher, which are the images I work with, are not metaphors, they are figurations. Deleuze calls them conceptual personae. I call them navigational tools. They are empirically grounded. It's, nomadism is about movement, but it is not one located in a place. It allows you to map a process. We need methodologies that are connected to process ontologies, as opposed to the kind of narrow empiricism that we have that gives you a methodology that can only take a slice of data and that's all you study. What if you study fluctuations then? Okay, you can do some of the maths, but it will never be good enough for us social scientists. So we are needing that type of conceptual navigational tool so that we can map, for instance, the breaking up of territory, mobility, features of hand of the 20th, early 21st century eras. So figurations, conceptual personae. Greg Lambert has a nice new book out on Deleuze's conceptual personae, where you see how he uses the stranger, the animal, the nomad, the woman also. And they are tools by which he's zooming in on the explosion of categories and their fluctuations. There is a lot of application of nomad thought to the Palestinian problem, to Korean and Chinese nationalism. You will find a whole literature now whereby you take in this and this notion and you apply it to categories that empirically you would think are marginal. Now, why would a Palestinian be a marginal category? Why would Chinese be a marginal category? So you can insert it into any category to deterritorialize it. That's the operation. It comes with a methodology. And it comes with a political project. The conversation is enormous, and I can anticipate 37 objections. But that's the idea. In any case, non-metaphors, figuration, conceptual persona, and navigational tools. I've touched on Islam. Where to begin with that? Tariq Ramadan, very, very outspoken European Islam. The issue is not religion, the issue is socioeconomics, and the issue, I think, is a certain idea of Europe. I think that remains a stumbling block. We were discussing this also today at lunch. Turkey has a massive problem with illiberal democracy, but then so does the United States of America. So I think whether the dividing lines are not now between liberal democracy, illiberal democracies, with the European Union hopefully staying on the side of liberal democracies, i.e. the people still decide, and with a division of labor between the different branches of the executive, a minimum amount, minimum. But we may lose this because we're in the minority in the world today. Enormous difficulties with dictatorship, whatever brand they may be. A bit of high nationalism. My Turkish friends are not happy with Erdogan dictatorship. My Israeli friends are not happy with the Jewish states. My Indian friends are not happy with the Hindu states. But we are in a state where, a moment where this wind of re-territorializing nationalistic identities are blowing. My students in South Africa are, again, we were talking about this, roads must fall, but roads must fall. And the falling folizization of the university doesn't mean that we have to Africanize the university. It depends what you mean by that. So I think we have to accept, but this is part of the job of a cartographic critical reading, that we are living in neo-nationalist times, so that there is a recoding of everything in nationalist terms. And we should make this the first of our struggles, because as Europeans, we have the project of the European Union. This has been our effort to defeat nationalism. It has backfired because of the oppositions to it, but the project is profoundly anti-nationalistic, it's post-nationalistic. And then let's look at the populist movements that are absolutely manipulating the project to push different agendas. I think we should use our own efforts to emerge from fascism after 45 to try to become new Europeans with all the problems, but we have really done a lot of work. We should give ourselves a little bit of a pat on the back. Not enough, not even nearly enough when it comes to imperialism and colonialism, but my Chinese colleagues haven't even started. And we have this conversation with all due respect on a daily basis. And when they say, we don't believe in your democracy, I say, well, we don't believe in your dictatorship, so how are we going to do business together? And then they laugh. But I say, ha-ha. But it's ha-ha that you think, how are we going to do this? And knowing that China owns Africa, practically, to cut a long story short. So how are we going to do this in terms of the role of the university? So I think that these questions now need to be rephrased beyond Islam, that is not the issue. There are far more complex issues, but Europe has prototypes of multi-religious enclave in Andalusia, in what used to be Bosnia and Herzegovina. We have prototypes that we can borrow from. We must remember also our own history on this. To be continued, it's the issue of the day.
There's a couple of more questions that I saw. I just want to ask connected questions. One is about the tradition that you're following, like co-tenants, Badiou, and the question of this like human agency, actually. So in the terms that you're using, like this defamiliarization, self-reflexivity, mobility, and this collective imagination and so forth, and it reminds me so much of human agency, like question. And like within the tradition that you follow, it was highly questioned. And on top of it, the post-colonial literature you are addressing, obviously. And the question started actually one of the early texts, as you know, this is like a Spivak's critique of Deleuze and Foucault.
In that unfortunate article, yes.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I mean,
debunking
the category of Europe also went along with that line. So, Spivak basically asking not simply this is about the colonial guilt and so forth, it's about this human agency, as if everything is our options, we can do like whatever we like, kind of thing, from the terminology of Deleuze and Foucault, as you as we all remember. And so, And that critique actually, even Spivak maybe did not follow afterwards, I don't know, so maybe you can mention that, but anyway, so this human agency question, I feel like it's coming too much to the front, even within these traditions that have questioned humanism, agency, everything is under our freedom, like logic. So, I want to emphasize again, this went along with the critique of the category of Europe, and the category of Europe was not the guilt of the colonialism, but this understanding of human agency under the category of Europeans. So that's why I'm asking, why do we still have to use the category of Europe in your own political analysis? While you associate it simply with an anti-fascist struggle, and we see the anti-fascist struggle is all over the world in different ways and much harsher forms as well, not only in Europe. Mm-hmm. Why should we still call it becoming European in the term we are using? I'm not saying, of course, in the way you criticize it. In the way you are using, do we have to use the category of Europe again after all these critiques?
What a wonderful set of multi-barreled questions. There's six questions in one, so I'll take it in order. Human agency comes from a different tradition, and it's much more Habermasian meets Rawls. It's the importation of American social theory through the denazification of the German social sciences after the Second World War, to cut a long story short. Everything that the French school rejected. And I think here you have the long, long shadow of post-war politics, with Germany emerging from the Second World War devastated, occupied and defeated. France emerges a winner, sitting in the UN Security Council, and they have Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. Thank you very much. That's the difference. And it's simply marks a whole philosophical generation. And I think that discussion, the missing discussion, Habermas-Foucault, and it was missing for very good reasons, is really part of a huge, huge divide here. And there's a whole stuff that we could talk about, Americanization and how that goes. The French hold on to their tradition, for better or for worse. And you have to give it to them, and in the long run, it doesn't do them much good either. But they're allowed to stick to their tradition. Human agency is not part of their tradition. Subjectivity and becoming subject is. And they have a glorious tradition of that, stretching all the way back to the 18th century, not only talking about identity, subjectivity, but talking about embodiment and sexuality. This is the culture of Denis Diderot. This is the culture of the Marquis de Sade. This is the culture that puts bodies, passions, at the core of the business, and all the way back, you find it all the way back, it's in their philosophy of science. Bachelard, Kangiyam, they're talking bodies, they're talking materials. And of course, Bachelard, completely coincidentally, happens to be the supervisor for the PhD of both Deleuze and Michel Serre. Little coincidence. And Kangiyam teaches Foucault the little that he knows about the history and philosophy of science. So there is a direct lineage between an epistemological tradition of bodily materialism and this philosophy of subjectivity. And subjectivity is not identity and is not agency. Subjectivity is always collective. It's you and the system and the networks and the laws. It's the collective assemblage. And it is their answer to the Marxist understanding of a class consciousness, which is also a collective identity. But in the Spinoza's terms, it becomes the collective assembly that allows us to do what? To do a mapping of our condition, a reading of what is happening to us in terms of material conditional productions, in terms of the order of discourse, in terms of politics of resistance, in terms of keeping alive and not giving in to the profound, dense sadness of the soul, which was Deleuze's description of microfascism, the sadness of your soul, where you simply think that nothing is possible anymore. If they get you to this point, they have won. It's profound sadness. It's the opposite of joyful affirmation. And if they get you there, you're dead, done, finished. So microfascism is some sort of spiritual death in some ways. So I think that is the tradition, and they post May 68, post-Marxist Hegelian shift of paradigm towards the Spinoza's turn, they actually re-embrace it, saying we need to reinvent subjectivity for this day and age. We're looking at the 70s, although it is clear to anybody, and the youth of the world was in Paris at the time, that communism was going. Why is it clear? Because from 76, 77, a guy called Solzhenitsyn is smuggling out of the Soviet Union bits of a novel called The Gulag Archipelago that is being smuggled out as a samizdat and is being published in French. And The Gulag Archipelago will be the first clear, first voice indictment of Soviet communism, demonstrating, in case there was any doubt, that the Soviet Union is one big giant air prison. So anybody who was still clinging on to the post-World War II vision of the country of socialism is defeated. We're talking about 67. Also in Paris, at the same time, 1979, from the outskirts of Paris, a guy called the Ayatollah Khomeini leaves the outskirts of Paris, get on a plane to go to Tehran to lead the first dutifully, democratically elected Islamist revolution. And then Foucault goes absolutely berserk, thinking, oh, we have an alternative. There's not only communism and democracy, there is an Islamist state. And we're thinking, you go take a leave of your senses. Are you crazy? Simone de Beauvoir says, can't believe what this guy is saying. He's going to put the veil on the women. Oh, says Foucault, never mind the veil. It's a huge thing. So, I mean, there's lots of stuff now on Foucault and the Iranian revolution. So by then, it is clear to anybody living around the French philosophy, see, the communism is finished. It's a question of time. And when communism goes, democracies will have a problem as well, because it is a beautiful dialectical binary couple here. The post-war consensus, if you go, I go. So what will take its place? That is Foucault's and Deleuze's project. What will take the place of the Cold War system, the Cold War order? That's what they do. That's why A Thousand Plateaus is an incredible book. Capitalism as Schizophrenia is what is coming. Even the first volume of that masterpiece, The Anti-Oedipus, if you look at volume two, chapter two of volume one, Deleuze and Guattari talk about the transformation of capitalism now that capitalism has stopped producing. Now, how did they know in 1972 that capitalism is stopping to produce? When is Margaret Thatcher elected? 78, right? 77, 78. It's a bit later. But when does Guy Debord publish For a Society of Spectacle? What year is that? 67, 68, Society of Spectacle. The first treaty on media, Guy Debord and the Situationist. 67, saying, guess what, guys? We are not producing anymore, we are reproducing. with the culture of media. There is a point where the French observatory gets it right. They get the mutation of capitalism. So at the time there is an entire anti-idiot in China, they say capitalism will destroy its industrial base because we don't need to produce anymore. It will be flows of data, and it will be credit, will be presented to you as credit. It will generate debt. Debt is the future. And debt is the future becomes the core of the work that somebody like Lazzarato is doing today. If you know Lazzarato's work on indebtedness, straight out of the Anti-Oedipus, he quotes it on page 2 of that book. 72, mutation of capitalism, financialization of the economy, the future is debt. Now, how brilliant is this? I was with Rega Ray and the radical feminists at the time. It took me a little bit of time, because, you know, those were the days, to actually understand the sheer genius of this. And the more you read it, the more you think, what? You know, because Thatcher demonstrates all of this, but it's 5 years later she comes in and destroys the industrial base, cracks the back of the unions, and invents neoliberalism. It was still to come. On sheer, shall we say, speculative philosophical premises, keeping their eyes open to the media culture. Guattari was the media man. Guattari was the free radio station man. If you know your German political history, all the roads lead to the free radio stations. No revolution without free radio station. They're the grandparents of internet. So Guattari knew the extent of the media, but Deleuze didn't have a clue. It was in the cooperation between them. So this is why subjectivity and the quest for an alternative political horizon is so much part of what they do. The response is overwhelmingly negative. The communist parties fall on them like a ton of bricks, saying, revisionist, complicitous with the system. And all the Leninists saying, oh my God. So particularly the communist parties of Italy, of France also block the stuff. And Deleuze, contrary to Foucault, is reckless. Deleuze is really good friends with a guy called Tony Negri. Tony Negri is a terrorist. He is in jail. He's reputed to be a terrorist. I think he is a lovely friend, like him dearly. But he's in jail, accused of terrorism. He is on every list of wanted terrorists. Deleuze writes a preface to Tony Negri's book, The Savage Anomaly, beautiful preface by Deleuze. Foucault gets really annoyed, and Foucault and Deleuze split over this. That's the difference, huh, politically. So Deleuze doesn't take care of his public relations, shall we say. And if there's one thing that you don't want to do in the 1970s is to have a very well-known terrorist among your friends. For those of you who do not know, terrorism was a major phenomenon in Europe in the 1970s. Very, very well-bred white children of very well-off families took Kalashnikovs and other things and started shooting in Italy, in Germany, but also in Spain and France, not. And Jacques Lacan, the psychoanalyst, claimed that he prevented the French youth from becoming terrorists. It was a very modest man, Jacques Lacan. So do never think of terrorism as something that is only Islamic. Ask yourselves why we don't have more PhDs on the years of terrorism in Italy and France, and why that episode has been deleted from my academic curricula, because that is one of the great sins that has been committed in the name of some sort of I don't know what. I have generated one PhD based on the Stasi archive, Katharina Karschner. She went in and did Baader-Meinhof, did it in Utrecht, was headhunted by Warwick, brilliant PhD at Warwick, was headhunted by Oxford. She's now in Oxford. So you can build a brilliant career if you do it well. But that, to come back to a long answer, did not help the cause of the Deleuze and Guattari's notion of subjectivity. They got tainted by the year of terrorism, and that delayed their reception. When the Americans exported French theory, they leave Deleuze behind, deliberately. Kristeva is translated simultaneously in French and English. Foucault becomes a megastar with the LGBT community propelling him to supernova status. Deleuze happens 25 years later. Nobody even knows how it happens. Nobody's orchestrating it, and it just takes off, which proves a fundamental European feminist rules that they can delay you, but they can never delete you, but they can sure delay you. I didn't answer you on Spivak. The article is tendentious because she picks up Derrida and makes excuses for him that she doesn't do for Deleuze and Foucault. The argument is untenable. And in fact, Derrida is even more of a Hegelian than all of them put together, even more of a universalist. The operation is totally flawed. I fully accept that she's devoted to Derrida, but this is a ridiculous piece of writing. It has to be reviewed, and they have to be put generationally on the same plane and see how the linguistic turn undoes the master discourse as opposed to the materialist turn, and doing it differently. But to say that one is metaphorizing and the other, no, it's simply untenable. And I think it's a piece of displaced loyalty from a very brilliant woman. I have to stop here because he's going to kill me. Why should we still be in Europe? All of my work is about, the recent one is about the constitution of the we. Who is the we who would want to take on the project of Europe? It all begins with the composition of a people, the composition of a plane of immanence. Who have we got? It's not compulsory. It cannot be anybody. I started the talk by saying, as a person situated, positioned here, I choose to take responsibility for my Europeanness. I became a European in Australia, where I grew up as an Italian migrant. All of a sudden, I thought, not only am I Italian, I'm actually European. It's in the loss of the attachment that I discovered the strength of its content, of its sensibility, of its sometimes ethereal elements. There is no compulsion here, there is no historical necessity, there is no Hegelian philosophy of history. There is a politic of affinities. If we are enough people that are converging around a political passion for the construction of subjects who desire another Europe, then we have a we who can start the conversation. Everything begins with the composition of a missing piece. This is where we have here neither postmodernist relativism nor its opposite, the essentialism of a subject who will be in charge of the course of history. We have nomadic subject construction. Who have we got? Who are we? Who are the we who would carry? I could summarize my talk by saying there is no people who want to carry a different Europe. We're squashed between antagonistic populisms and people who, you know, don't have an attachment to Europe, which is perfectly fine. I would like to compose a different people, people from within the center devoted to a different understanding of Europe, activating the center, and then making encounters with multiple other entities fighting similar struggles across the world. Eurocentrism is by far not restricted to Europe. I can make a list of places where Eurocentrism is doing much better, especially in the universities, than in Europe. So I think you have here a complex mapping. I have to go quickly or you will sack me.
That's all. You can take your time in answering. Kirsten
Maike. Yeah, my name is Kirsten Maike. I'm a literary scholar, and I thank you very much for your passion. It's very contagious.
Good.
I have two questions concerning first the binary thing. I very much agree with your arguments and the need to get out of the binary logics of Aristotelian tradition. But why do you still need then the category of minoritarian, center and periphery, that somehow still sticks to binary opposition logics? Couldn't we just think about something which goes beyond, like complementarity, some kind of unhierarchical conviviality, living together, like they're developing. We had a seminar today about the concept of buen vivir in the Andes, where the concept of unhierarchical thing is very important, and the need to combine opposites instead of excluding the other. So this is a question about your concept. And then the other question is about affect. I agree with your arguments about the post-national, of the need to get out of the nationalist European, we need the idea to overcome. every nationalism, even be it a European one. I don't think that the aspect that you feel or the love that you feel when you listen to a dialect, or that you feel when you see a mountain that reminds you of your home, is the same thing as nationalism. It's not all nationalism. It can be just a feeling of affinity or belonging. And I would like to make a difference there.
Interesting.
And I think to do without, or to really get off all affective belongings to regionality would not help very much.
Mm-hmm.
So,
interesting, great one.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, again, complicated. Maybe I start the second one. I think I can deal with more swiftly, probably. I think we need an affective mapping of our ecologies of belonging. It's a thin line between the reassuring presence of smells, shapes, sounds that confirm your identity and their sacralization into icons of belonging. It's a thin line. Marine Le Pen is superb, and her father was even better, if you really want to look at it as rhetorical skills, at transforming that into the core of your identity. It's where you really belong. And it means that you and your neighbor are closer than the people who are a street below and the town next door and the region next door. It is this idea of the circle working outwards, which is like a pathology, really. Thin lines, but I think we need different mappings of this, because I agree with you, not all nationalisms are sick. I haven't seen many that are very, very healthy, but okay, I'm a bit skeptical, shall we say, but I would be very interested in seeing different ways of coding this, and I would also be very interested to see how mediation changes this, because between us and the millennial is the mediation of internet, and that is their home. That's where you guys live. Facebook pages, how many friends? How many likes and dislikes? How many sort of social networks? Is that the home? Because if that is the case, then we have a very different ecology of belonging and different modes of going about this. I am of the generation, I always say this to my LGBT students, we used to send cards. I used to send cards saying, would you like to come out? How's that about sexting? And and again, the research on this, the millennials are a planet of their own, because you're not talking, you're not writing your MAs on practices of sexting in my generation, certainly not. You're far from it. There is a real protection of your culture from us, I suppose, that makes the conspiracy of silence really, really complicated to deal with. So I would love to see an effective mapping where mediation, what do you do when it's all visual? Is it all visual? Are there other ways in which this is being mediated? So that would be, I would be open to that with a little bit of skepticism on whether healthy nationalisms are possible and whether they all not degenerate into some sort of micro-fascistic formation. I'm thinking of liberation wars, and then inevitably there's always a moment. But I think the crucial question for me was the first one on the binary thinking. So, I completely agree with you that we need to work on language. We need different language. And here again, I am betraying my generation, the Gutenberg generation that used language. I am not sure that the language of algorithms is language, or whether codes and different systems of signification are not replacing. I'm now looking again at the younger generation. I'm not sure that what you speak is language, as opposed to some sort of code system or signal system or algorithmically mediated code of communication. There's a lot of work on algorithmic cultures. And it's, I don't know, because I think it's new, but I do hope that you will write your work on it and explain it so that we can all have this conversation. For us, language was fundamental. For my teachers, absolutely central. This is the generation that went through the linguistic turn. They went through linguistics, semiotics, and psychoanalysis. They went through Saussure, Lacan, Jakob, the importance of language. And language in this philosophical tradition is not an instrument of communication. Language is not a tool of communication. Language is an ontological site. Language speaks you. Look around this room and name every single object that you see. You would not know the name of half of them. Open the dictionary, well, you can't anymore because you're online, but imagine you have it in paper. Open it at random and look up a word. Chances are you wouldn't have a clue. Language was there before you. Language will be there after you. Tough luck whether you learn to speak it or not. It's the famous linguistic turn. It's Jacques Lacan saying, you think you're the king or creator, you are an effect of grammar and syntax. It's called structuralism. Structuralism is incredibly important. Saussure and Jacobson do it with the structures of language. Lacan throws in the unconscious. Oh, you're really volition? Willpower? Oh, please. You are driven by your libido like a rabid dog. Hormonally challenged forever. As if you think it gets better with age, think again. It does not. We are driven by our passions, by our desires. Desires are that which remains unthought, because it is that which generates the thinking in the first place. And it is necessarily unthought because it is what drives you. You want to know what you desire? It's always a posteriori. It's always the wrong affair, the wrong person at the wrong time, and it's always the best things in life. It's always wrong. And afterwards, you turn back, you look at the pattern, and say, I did it again, didn't I? Say, yeah, says your best friend, you've done it again. Your symptoms are your lovers. They're staring you in the face. The best mistakes of your life, you are driven. A posteriori, you can say, yes, I do like brunettes after all. After six blondes or whatever. It's a posteriori reconstruction of your desire. You are driven. You are the effect of your passions. I think if you think of the unconscious as an adjective, not as an object, but unconscious desires, unconscious longing, and they determine our life. And when academia got involved into the star system and the commodification system, then people, they want to be the next Deleuze, or they want to be the next Judith Butler, the next big thing, and it's all confusing and terribly exciting. And a posteriori, you can then detect the patterns, yeah, afterwards. So that's psychoanalysis. That's why psychoanalysis, please give it a chance. It's a fantastic philosophy of desire. Don't believe Deleuze when he says it's all wrong. He says it and he has his argument, but he has read it. Don't reject something without having read it first. So read some Lacan and then see why the Deleuze critique of Lacan is fair. And of course, the Marxists, we are the effect of economic structures. Language as the ontological site of formation, it names you. For one thing, language gives you an option of being a he, a she, or an it in some languages. Now. Sexual difference enters the conversation. What does it mean that in the third person of singular, in some languages plural as well, in the third person, sexualization enters the game. And I'm choosing my language carefully. Sexualization. Didn't say genderization. I said sexualization. What does it mean? That you need to be able to do a double operation. You need to say, okay, this is I, and this I is a he or a she. You have to think of yourself in the third person, so meta-reversive, self-reflexive, very complicated neurological operation. Autistic children can't do it. I am a he, or I am a she, and of course all the questions in between that we all know about by now, but knowing your place in the order of things is the beginning of sanity. It's the law. And here we open a very, very thorny set of discussion with Julia Kristeva being the right-wing Lacanian and Lucy Rigueret, the left-wing Lacanian, saying, but there is a multitude of positions in between that we can take. And then comes American queer theory, simplifies everything, and runs away with it. I've published it. Julia and I are great friends, and she knows how I feel about this. It's basically wrong. But the complexities and multiplicity, but a rule that says... And then you get Octavia Butler and all the science fiction writers saying, I want to call myself zip, floop, zlick, or an algorithm, which is my favorite. Just give me a code, a Bitcoin system of block identities. That's perfectly fine. Immediately the experimentation begins. And my teachers are always ridiculed for writing difficult language. I mean, Derrida would be, how much rubbish have they? But they do it on purpose. They declare war on the seeming transparency of language, saying it's really bad for you to actually be induced into believing that you are understanding what language means. Reread Alice in Wonderland, my favorite philosophy book written by a brilliant logic professor, pedophile but brilliant. When Humpty Dumpty says, when I want a word to mean something, I give it the right instructions. If I want that word to do extra work, I pay it extra. The question is, who is the boss? Humpty Dumpty. Who is the boss of meaning? Extraordinary stuff. If language, you have to read Alice in Wonderland as a logic treaty, if you're, particularly if you're into programming and stuff, incredible text. So they get into language and say, how do we make it give away its game? Derrida's deconstruction, he just opens the language and says, look at how power works, look. He does a dissection game. And Guattari reconstruct. They use incredible language, which irritates the hell out of people, but also I find it incredibly exciting. So majoritarian, minoritarian, nomadic, sedentary, becomings, and all of, they are all variations. And if you, the Thousand Plateaus is written as a musical score, and every section is called Memoirs of. It's a memoir. It's like affective traces of. And within that, they play a set of modulations. So experimentation with writing is fundamental. I was trained at the Sorbonne. I shouldn't say that in Germany because it just feeds German suspicion of the French. We were trained not to be too transparent, not to assume clarity of meaning. What would clarity fetishism? That's Gayatri Spivak, clarity fetishism. What? You the boss of language? I don't think so. I really don't think so. So experimenting, opening up, disguising, and I think style here is not rhetorical. It's a politics of non-transparency, assuming that we know where language is going to get us, and language gets us to follow logocentrism. God is one. He is a man. He is white, he's a white beard. Haven't you been to the Sistine Chapel? Where have you been all your life? Under a rock? Get your facts straight. And there are two sexes, and one is in control, and the other one is the second sex. Any other question, please? Follow logocentrism. That's where language is going to go. It's history, it's mankind, it's God the Father. And when Lacan says woman is not, he's simply saying, hey, what world are you living in? The universal is expressed in the masculine. In every Indo-European language. Any questions? Lucy Rigueret writes a PhD to try to challenge that question. Lacan fails the PhD and destroys Lucy Rigueret's career. Follow logocentrism. There's one law, and the binaries will be enforced. So you can play your games, but be careful because the law is there waiting for you. This is why then Deleuze and Guattari attack this, saying, how can you say that there is one law holding for all places? And then you get post-structuralism critiquing this. So the binaries are there, but I would argue their function is analytic, not normative. You are forced by language to say, if I say minority, I say majority. It's in the language. And Deleuze uses the binaries, but as an analytic tool. It's not a substantive, it's not the role of the negative in Hegelian philosophy, where unless you negate the negation, you don't get a positive, you're with me. This is actually, yes, there's this and, and it is a crucial thing in the sequences of Deleuze, is the three dots, and. It's becoming woman, becoming minor, becoming earth, becoming imperceptible. It's the process. And he encourages us passionately to use our own language. He detested imitators. I took his classes for years. He didn't want us to repeat. He didn't want us to be particularly loyal. How can you be loyal to a radical thinker? Do your own thing. Just respect the basic rule, politics of affirmation, war against the negative, not dialectical binaries, construct communities that can hope and activate together. And within that, much more creativity. I have pleaded for years for fundamental humanities labs where we could work on the language. Can we invent a new language, please? Writers are doing it. Writers, you know, who teaches literature anymore? We're killing all of those literature departments across the EU. The war on the humanities is full out. Soon we will not be able to teach even literature because it does not correspond to the spirit of the age. Thank God we have the algorithmic brigades. They're doing everything with codes. Maybe that's the way to go. It's very promising. It's a whole world out there. The experimentation needs to continue, but we may have lost the first round on how to undo that binarism of language in ordinary language. If I may just be difficult for one more time, I think the tragedy of the humanities is the Humpty Dumpty syndrome, that we are using ordinary language to do extraordinary things. And that's what Humpty Dumpty teaches, that if we want language to do extraordinary things, we have to pay it more. We have to give it something extra. Using ordinary language to do extraordinary work is irritating the taxpayers. Say, why you talk difficult? Well, actually, if I was speaking in physical, in terms of maths, you would respect him as a specialist. If I use complex language, in what sounds to you like ordinary language, you say I'm using jargon. Now, that's the tragedy of the humanities, that no respect for the competences that come from asking ordinary language to do extraordinary things. We may die of this in this populist era, where there is no respect for our complexity, but any respect for any complexity of anybody speaking remotely STEM language or algorithm. Oh, then they're specialists. We're trying to be disguised within ordinary language, jargon. I think politically, both the Derrida and Deleuze founded alternative universities, Derrida, the Collège International de Philosophie, and Deleuze, Université de Vincennes. They created alternative universities. So much did they believe in the function of critical language. I can talk for hours, but I will not.
Are you still happy to take a
I'm
couple?
Vaguely alive, not for much longer, but...
I saw at least one more question. Is there, like, let's do a round of final questions. And okay, wonderful. So I see Larissa and the... in the back. Somebody else. Okay, wonderful. So we have three more questions.
Very good.
If they're not utterly like six questions in one, we
should. I know there will be. You're clever lot.
Well, so basically, Larissa, you have to.
Hello?
Where are you? Oh, yeah, I couldn't see you.
I'm a member of the graduate college student in the Global Life Girls. I think I'm speaking for all of us here, and that I find this really inspiring. However, I'm researching on activism, so I'm wondering more on the practical dimension of this political project. And I was wondering how can we practically implement this project, and how can we convince others of the benefits of this project? And maybe to make a connection to a recent example here in Constance, there was this big movement building up in Constance as well as in other German cities, which was called Pulse of Europe. I don't know if you heard about it. So it was really vague.
Piles of Europe?
Pulse.
The Pulse of Europe. There's been a lot of stuff. Yeah, go. I don't know about this one, but Varoufakis is a movement. There's all sorts of movements.
So it was really big in Constance because there were around 1,000 people gathering each Sunday, which is quite a big amount for Constance.
Okay, imagine, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but there was something that I found really difficult about this movement because, for example, they were waving European flags, or they asked refugees as well as other people to give hold a love story on Europe. It was really vague and no real positionings. And so I was wondering, how would you rate this movement? Does it go in a direction that you
I don't know this particular movement, I must say. I have been involved a bit in the new one that Varoufakis did a bit with Zizek, not my favorite, but never mind, on alternatives for Europe, and I'm involved in small size ones. I don't know this particular one. But I want to ask you, what is wrong with waving an EU flag? I'm serious. What is wrong with that? I want to hear your objection. What is wrong with foregrounding the fact that the EU
is taking refugees. I'm Australian, and I see what happens to refugees in Australia. I teach at Yale and in other places. I see what the US is not doing for refugees. There's a ban on Muslim countries on the USA. So that's why I'm asking. It's not a cynical question, it's a serious question. Is it because it smacks of nationalism? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think there's a certain danger of maybe just replacing this German flag with the European flag. And this feeling of superiority as well. And also, I think it is also important to point maybe at the problems, at the recent problems, that so many people are drowning in the Mediterranean Sea. So then I see a certain problem when you ask refugees to give a love story on Europe.
It's pushing it a bit, yeah. I'm with you on this. However, can I be an academic, be boring for a moment, and go back to the question, because I don't have an answer, it's a real question. How do we construct a collective social imaginary of Europe? I'm not particularly a fan of any flags, I get them all confused. I don't even know the difference between the Italian and the Irish, because they're the same, but I always confuse them, whatever. Also, the New Zealand and the Australian, like you're really pushing it, you have to count the stars, you know what. So it's a joke, but if you have many countries, you have this problem. But how else do we go about building a European public sphere, which Habermas says, and again, the old wise man, I always disagree and I always respect him. I've said it before, I will say it again. Post-nationalistic space, but then how do we construct this? And maybe we need to, make it into a serious program, like with 7 steps. First, you wave the flag, then you put it down and you have a serious conversation about what's missing. I mean, that we have like an Alcoholic Anonymous that we put ourselves through. No, but that we do construct a public sphere, because it is true that Poland is not taking them and Hungary is building walls. So we also need to boost what people call good, cases of good practice. And we need to defeat the Euro pessimism and the guilt that always comes up every time we think. So we always have to stress everything that is wrong with what we do and always downplay what is right. Maybe we need to have a provisional morality and do a positive and a negative, but we need to move on from this. We are the only people who are trying to do anything about the refugees. That's the reality. You heard Trump and Australia, I'm going to hand in my passport if they continue like this. It's just atrocious what they're doing. So I think it's that intermediary thing. Is your intervention not stressing it again? The problem is our unresolved relationship to nationalism that is also playing a role in the construction of what could be a post-nationalist sphere, but then we don't know what it is. Then is not the project precisely who are the we that would be willing to work on this? And I think it has to be taken as a really pragmatic program. I think universities have a role to play on this. And exactly a bit along the lines, Europeans looking at Europe, positive and affirmative, and moving on this. And I would be very prepared to do a series of workshops with steps towards this. But I would endorse anything that would get us into a public discussion about this. I think that we have an inbuilt reflex of Euroscepticism. It's built in. It's part of our guilt. It's part of our habit. It's part of a certain intellectual laziness. It's the easier thing to do. Oh, we're not that great. Sorry, if you compare us to the United States, we are heroic. A third of the Italian economy is working for the refugees. Italy is almost alone on the Mediterranean. The money goes into it. I have friends in Lampedusa who are doing this. So is this not true then? So it's a bit getting a more nuanced vision of this. I know I'm on thin waters here, but I would be prepared to take this risk to run this experiment with the usual question, who is the we? Who have we got who would join us in this? And I think there are many scattered initiatives at the moment, but there are alternatives for Europe and not for Deutschland coming up that are, I think, really interesting. And so I would support it. I would be prepared to take the risk, but with an Alcoholic Anonymous step system. Spinoza talks about poison and antidotes. So you're taking the antidote in small doses. He's really talking about detoxing, like detoxing from a bad sort of drug, or from a bad addiction. I think we're, and I would be prepared to support a detoxing from the negative so we can get to an affirmative politics with all the risks involved. And I think the universities have a role to play in this.
If you still have a,
sure.
What, 2 minutes, then we take the last very last question in the back.
You've been nodding a lot, so I'm very glad you're talking.
I'm a South European, so I'm not going to biography. Thank you very much for this kind of philosophy of the on and top, because in a sense you said, well, it's anti-dialectic, and I like very much the kind of criticism of that tradition. I also like the way you engage with tradition, and yet basically with breaking the tradition, which is always, I mean, what you said about subjectivity or le sujet, la subjectivation, etc. So I very much like that. Now, I have maybe this, so one first question about this, or based on that. I wonder if there is not a kind of tradition to what you are suggesting here, which is, and I'm a great reader and admirer of Mark Bloch, the fact that Europe was born taking away, in a sense, the classical Latin Christian culture of the Mediterranean,
mm-hmm.
and basically putting it to the north.
Putting
and
it to?
To the north.
To the north. Brother. Yeah, yeah.
And basically then building up. And Mark Bloch is not the only one. I mean, Kirin could mention Heusinger, etc. A whole generation of historians, medievalists, who have made a substantial contribution to understanding that. So, of course, it's not our Europe, but it seems to me that there are connotations here which
interesting.
Possibly mention. Second point as a Frenchman. Born in the 60s, with a father who went to Algeria because he had to.
Mm.
I've always been struck by a missing book, which would be La Crise Algérienne de la Pensée Française. Many of these people were born in Northern Africa, and all of them engaged with Northern Africa. And with Algeria.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I wonder to what extent this is something which is not very common. I mean, to the extent that people as different as Derrida and Deleuze
mm-hmm.
wrote the last, a very nice last book on Augustine, the Augustine.
Yeah, fantastic. What a wonderful point. A series of things there. So
we take the last question.
Oh, sorry,
well,
I beg your pardon. Yes, sorry.
So we take that together, so
okay.
Then you have the last word.
They're probably very different, but fine.
Yeah, this one will be...
Wait. Mediation.
This one will be very quick. It draws on your title, on the very framing of your project, Europe as a historical and political concept, both Europe and European Union, Western European concepts. And ironically, recently, so since 1991, the whole process of the ideologies of catching up in the East were framed in terms of becoming European. And of course, this is a totally different project of becoming European. It's becoming European as catching up with the Western concept of European Europeanness and being European otherwise. And of course, one is a conceptual project, one is a very practical project. So, these are actually two questions. One, how do you deal with the legacy of Westness of both concepts, historical and political, that you refer to? And, how, again, I'm coming back to the question already posed, how do you translate this into doing?
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll start from there, then I will return and so we go out with the friend. The issue of East-West is enormous, post-89, but also beyond. I was involved with Maria Lavayova in this project called Forma West, which talks about how post-89 the West changes and not just the East, and extremely interesting. In terms of my arguments for politics of immanence and politics of location, however, it doesn't really change a whole lot. It is absolutely clear that Eastern Europe is a different location, dramatically different. It is equally true that what happens after 89 is a tornado and that goes through the former East, recoding it under the Pax Americana of the times, Obama end of history, that horrendous decade where Eastern Europe really gets recolonized. And what happens to the universities in Eastern Europe in that decade is extremely interesting. And this hasn't been researched enough. It's a major cleansing. that happens. Does the people contaminated by communism have to go? It's a whole operation that has not been studied. I'm not sure that even we have the archives. So I think all of that needs to be put now, maybe the time is passing, into some sort of perspective. I saw a massive imposition of American social and cultural theory across the East in gender issues is just absolutely extraordinary. After 60 years of communist feminism and socialist feminism, from one day to the other, only Californian feminism matters in Eastern Europe. It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare. It's changing now, but I mean, the fact that Soros goes through Eastern Europe constructing Europe universities as he goes and helps and doesn't help the situation. It's a complex operation. There is a partial deletion of an archive, and there is the regeneration of a new field. I think it's not for me to say, because I only know this secondhand from people like Joanna Regulska, who writes beautiful essays, is the post in post-colonial the same as the post in post-communist? And it's not, but it is. It's very interesting. And then some countries, like South Africa, can claim to be both post-colonial and post-communist, because Mandela will say that he's a communist to the end of his day. Communism is a philosophy of national liberation, as it was in Algeria and in many, as it was in Europe. Communism fought fascism. Stalin was our great ally against the fascists. My students don't know that. They sort of confuse the facts of history post-89. Complex situation, complex genealogy. After 89, the old partisans, the communist partisans in places like Italy, France, Spain, go into mourning. In Italy, it was a tragedy when communism officially dies. The entire generation of anti-fascist resistance go into depression. We even had cases of suicide. So all of that needs to be looked at with the privilege of hindsight. I would say that it's absolutely urgent to do the politics of location in an Eastern European perspective in the light of what is happening now, i.e. the repetition of patterns of hyper-nationalism, which are really, in my modest, I'm absolutely not a historian, I'm only a superficial critic of fascism from philosophical traditions. They are really showing bits of unprocessed stuff from the Second World War. And in the Balkans, it was obvious in the 1990s. This was the Ustashas. It was all that story returning. The East doesn't get denazified. The East goes from Nazi occupation to communist occupation. I mean, what a story. And everything gets frozen, and it gets defrosted in 89. Well, it's a hell of a defrosting exercise. So the patterns of repetition here are really interesting. And I would take them very seriously and look at them as repetition without differences, and institute a Spinoza's system of massive detoxing from the return of microfascism. These people are off their heads. Hyper-nationalist, hyper-Christians subjected to Putin, what is that? While getting billions from Brussels. LGBT communities worried about the famous transgender bathrooms. I'm a member of the LGBT community, not worried at all about what's happening to refugees. Priorities here, identity politics more important than basic solidarities. I think we need to compose a people, and I would go for this because coming also from the region of Italy that borders, I come from Friuli, which is part of the East, this is part of my family genealogy, I would love to work on how do you sort of do truth and reconciliation in Europe, so to speak. That we talk about what happened in 45, in 48, and then, you know, I was a kid, but, you know, Budapest was the 56, was the first one, and then Prague, 68. I mean, the East resisted, for Christ's sake. Do people even know that? There is a deletion of a memory and patterns of horrendous repetition. I think we need to compose a people who can stand there and say, just a moment, I would prefer not to, actually. The famous of Battlesby in Deleuze's essays Critical and Clinical. I would prefer not to, not in my name anyway, and can we have this conversation again? I mean, intervention. Otherwise, the patterns of repetition is everything that was not processed in 45, 46 is coming out here again. And I think if we could have a political class and an academic class, that the war on academics is enormous, as we know, that actually talks about this in relaxed terms, in normatively neutral terms. We need to detox here. We have a social disease. And I do think Spinozism, Critical and Clinical, is the way that I would do this. But yes, it's a powerful other location that needs to be taken a lot more seriously. And I think some places are doing, the Institute in Vienna is trying, Rutgers with Regulska was trying, but there's not enough academic work on this. This deserves to be put much more. Maybe there's something you should do, get money from Brussels and constitute a big community. I will work with that with pleasure. On the question of the sort of the North appropriation of the classics. I mean, I remember my friend Svetlana, she's in Ljubljana, my band is gone. Anyway, Svetlana, from Ljubljana, the Institute of Human Sciences is in Ljubljana, wrote a piece called Why is Greece Not the Balkans? Why is Greece not the Balkans? Because Lord Byron went there, essentially, carved it out and says, this is Greece, it's classical Greece. In fact, it had been Ottoman for 600 years, nothing to do with anything, classical. So there is that sense, there's a long history to this as well. And I think also where the North-South thing plays is on the issue of fascism. I mean, the North can pride itself in not having had it. And I think that the Dutch, for all of their problems, the Danish, they can say what they want. They don't have a fascist bone in their entire system. They just don't. We can talk a bit about their problems, but it's nothing like the Italian reflex. First I punch you up, then we talk, which is the reflex of the true fascist. So the fact that the North is sort of clean and innocent does create a big problem. I think it plays a big role in Brexit. If the British had a sort of an adequate, in a Spinoza sense, understanding of themselves, they would recognize the sign of fascism in their own country. But because they are delusional, they don't. We people, countries that have had fascism, can read the signs immediately. This is an argument for Roberto Esposito's immunity system. If the social body has had the disease, you have the antibodies. This is actually proto-fascist. I'm not going there. If you've never had it, you actually are ignorant. You can't even pick up the signs. That's an aside. So I think there is that story. I think it has got a long tradition. I'm not sure that it is, I don't know in what spirit you were saying it. I do think that there is, at the moment, I notice a revival of philology, for instance. The new philology goes in this direction. Even the next Deleuze conference is on Deleuze and philology, just imagine. Like the precision of the actual, so we say, roots and origin of certain concepts. But it's a sign of health rather than a problem. I was fascinated by the point you made about la crise algérienne de la pensée française. I do think that the generation of my teachers, Foucault, Deleuze, etc., did not do enough with that, except Derrida and Sixou with Mon Algérienne, and of course Derrida being the Jewish Algerian. But the reason why they didn't is the generation before them, notably Sartre and Beauvoir, were so into it. I mean, the Algerian crisis is the story for the existentialist, phenomenologist generation. The people who are just that, I mean, in Italy it would be Luisa Passerini, whose work on Europe, by the way, is extremely interesting. She has the ERC on images of Europe, extraordinary woman. She says, without Algeria, there is no perception of the free Europe. It was the rite de passage, it's where people understood what was happening. And Fanon, I mean, without Fanon, and again, the role of psychiatry, psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, in Fanon's work on violence, what are the traces of violence, of contempt? What does it take out of you? I think it was so dominant for that generation that it kind of got underplayed in the subsequent one. And then you get Glissant and Guadeloupe and that sort of Aimé Césaire student coming up. Of course, Fanon was one of them as well, but it's a different slant coming in. Françoise Vergès, whom I'm sure whose work you know, they're coming in on a slightly different angle. But there is a strong Oedipalization, in a sense, in the intellectual class. Sartre did it, so I'm not going to do it. But why don't you write that book? It would be phenomenal. I think it is, I mean, also in literature, what it is the prism that brings the entire North African continent absolutely into focus. And what it did to Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was involved in that, to special forces. I mean, it's a prototype. And the best film on terrorism ever made, The Battle of Algiers, Ponte Corvo, 61. If you want to see a movie that gets terrorism and suicide bombers right, 1961, Ponte Corvo, The Battle of Algiers, with a very young Claudio Cardinale, among other things, but real suicide bombers as well. Extraordinary. The laboratory for what was to be Rive Gauche, a couple of, well, a decennia almost later. So looking forward to it. And Luisa Passerini is a person you need to invite. She has all of this down to a T about the connection between Europe and this larger Europe. You know that when the days when Romano Prodi was the commissioner, there was a famous white paper at the European Commission, which was to extend the European Union all across the Mediterranean and bring back Alexander the Great's maps of Europe. I would go with that. Imagine if we had done that, how much better off we would be today if we had made that Mediterranean part of this. There was a problem, of course, between Israel and the Palestinians, so it couldn't be even discussed. But the project exists, the white paper exists, so I rest my case. The European Union, always great ideas. How to implement them, however, remains the challenge.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Hard work.
Well, thank you very much for having come, having stayed, having provoked us, having inspired us. It was wonderful to have you here.
Thank you.